Now, my subject tonight is learning to lead wisely. And therefore, I want to give attention to the subject of leadership, at least in some measure tonight. I want to consider the importance of listening and learning. We listen in order to learn. We learn in order that we might lead in some capacity. And godly wisdom is foundational to good leadership. So if we have some desire to lead, and even if we have no desire at this present stage, as I will point out in a little while, all of us are called to leadership at some stage in some way or another. And what is required of us is that we have that godly wisdom to form our judgments and to direct us aright. You will notice what is said in verse 15 of Proverbs 8, by me, that is, by wisdom, kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me, princes rule and nobles, all the judges of the earth. So why the subject of leadership? Who is interested in the subject of leadership? Are you? Am I? I have to confess that the subject of leadership in the early part of my ministry, maybe the middle part of my ministry, was not top of the agenda. I was in a position, I occupied it, it was the role to which I was called. And yes, I was to lead. But I hadn't really thought through the implications and the ramifications of leadership until, I think, some later years in my life. We are to be interested. We are to be involved at some level. And I suggest that each and every one of us had better be involved in leadership and interested in it, because, like it or not, to a greater or lesser degree, you're going to be entrusted with the role of leadership. Somebody asked the question, who in his right mind would want to be a leader? It's probably a lot easier not to be a leader and not, as it were, to draw attention to yourself so much. Let somebody else lead, and I will just simply follow along. And the leader himself can have all the brickbats, can have all the hassles, etc., and I'll just simply see which way the wind may blow. Who would admit that God calls every one of us to lead? And the dilemma is this. God does call every one of us to lead. If we teach a Bible study or take a position as a nursery worker, then we are leading in some capacity or another. All of us are called at some stage to lead, but it is how we lead and what our understanding of leadership is all. Let me consider, first of all, the call to leadership. What a privilege, is it? Is that how you think? Well, yes, it is a privilege. When God calls us and summons us to follow him, then he shapes us and equips us for some role, however insignificant, of leadership. We may not have too many young men here tonight, but I would address them. Because you young men may one of these days get married, and one of these days you may well not only become a husband, but you'll become a father. And you need to begin now at this stage in your life to learn your potential role and responsibilities as a leader in the home that you yourself are going to establish. So you begin now. You don't wait until you become a husband. You don't wait until you become a father. Already you should be thinking seriously about the obligations and the necessary equipment so that you can undertake this particular role. The one-time president of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, early in his life, made a decision to build the traits of a leader into his life or die trying to build those traits into his life. So he was a young man, and as a young man, he considered and contemplated the future that lay ahead of him, and he realized that there are obligations, there are responsibilities. And so even though I am not yet married, even though I am not a father, I am going to build into me or have built into me those necessary qualifications that will suit me and serve the interest not only of myself but others whom I lead. And it so happened that he esteemed very highly his father, who assisted him in his resolve, because he did so by the pattern of his life, by the example of this father of his. Roosevelt goes on to say, "I was fortunate enough to having a father whom I have always been able to regard as an ideal man." He looked, therefore, to his father, and in this way, he prepared for leadership. It was a privilege. He regarded it as a privilege. But then there was this preparation for leadership, and he had a model, and that model was his father. He says of his father, "He combined the strength and courage and will and energy of the strongest man with the tenderness, cleanness, and purity of a woman." Roosevelt goes on to say, "I was a sickly and timid boy. But he, my father, took not only great and untiring care of me. Some of my earliest remembrances are of nights when he would walk up and down with me for an hour at a time in his arms when I was wretched with suffering acutely, nightly suffering with asthma. But he also most wisely refused to coddle me and made me feel that I must force myself to hold my own with other boys and prepare to do the rough work of the world." So here was indeed a man among men, in a sense, if you listen to what Roosevelt has to say about his father. And here was true masculinity. There was that strength, indeed, which was physical, but there was also the strength of that mind which applied itself to all the various commitments that his father had. And so he undertook to take care of his son, and he did so. And in doing that, he loved his son, cherished his son, especially in times of sickness. But he wouldn't mollycoddle his son. He wouldn't pamper his son because his son happened to be suffering in these ways. And sometimes I suppose you can have a disabled child, or a child is not quite as they ought to be in certain respects, and you may somehow give your attention to them rather than the other members of the family. This is what this father would not do. Theodore came to take up boxing, which actually added to his character as a leader. I don't know whether boxing is the way that you young men should go, but maybe martial arts. There may be a place for that. And maybe parents, in fact, might encourage both their sons and their daughters to consider some form of martial arts in these days, as being suited to the building of character. Roosevelt says we must have the right kind of character, character that makes a man, first of all, a good man in his home, a good man as a husband and as a father. Must make him a good father, a good husband, and that makes a man a good neighbor. So here was the privilege of leadership, but then there was the necessary preparation for leadership, as he committed himself to what lay ahead with regards to the task that he was going to be fulfilling as a leader among men. Here's a word to young men, therefore. Take seriously the calling, take seriously the task that will be laid at your feet to assume the role of leadership, and begin now. hopefully you can look at your father and that he is a model to you, an example to you of what a husband and a father ought to be. And build upon that and hence become leaders in whatever area God calls you to. But I think that this call goes not simply to young men. Indeed, it goes to old men as well. Old men should be setting the pace, as it were. They should be models to be imitated. They should be exemplary. But here's a word for young women. Because young women, you too will have a leadership role as a parent under the supervision of your husband. Make sure, young men, make sure, husbands, that your wife does not wear the trousers. She wears the skirts, that's fine. She does not wear the trousers. You are those who are appointed as heads of households. And regardless of what the feminists may say today and the way our society is drifting so that it's blurring the distinctions between the sexes and their respective responsibilities, I hope that you will have such a biblical view of the complementary but distinct roles between a husband and a wife, between a man and a woman, that you will not allow or tolerate effeminacy to come into your thinking so that it is the wife who calls the shots. You are to be a leader in your own home. You are to be a leader in your own house. And young women, I hope that you will get it into your head that if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, you will willingly submit to your husband. Mind you, the husband you submit to must be easy to submit to simply because he loves you as Christ loves the church. That's the kind of husband that you are to submit to, so that here's a husband who loves the wife as Christ loves the church. In Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8, the exhortation is to the young man. Here's the father sitting down with his son, and he's going through some of the necessary lessons of life itself. And he says, among other things, forsake not your mother's teaching. Young ladies, if you become mothers and raise children, it isn't as if the husband alone does the teaching. Of course, we got this notion in our head that women, in fact, can do other things. I mean, hey, what are mothers for? Well, mothers are there to provide food. Mothers are there to pick up my pants, which I've left on the floor, and my dirty socks, which stink, etc., and throw it all into the laundry. Mothers are there to make my bed. Mothers are there to provide me sandwiches. Mothers are there just to give me medication, etc., when I need it, and to somehow cool my brow when I have a fever. That's what mothers are for, but not to teach. Yes, you young ladies are to learn the scriptures, to learn the word of God, that under the supervision of your husband, you will have that opportunity to teach your own children. Your husbands are going to be away from home early in the morning until late at the end of the day. They're going to be dead tired by the time they come home, which doesn't mean to say, dads, that when you come home, you just simply put your feet up, put on your slippers, as it were, have the daily paper at your side, turn on the goggle box, and so on, and you do nothing else with respect to how you relate to your wife or you relate to your children. Not at all. But through the day, children will be at home until eventually they go to school. And going to school, they'll go to school at the age of 5, maybe, or 6 or 7. And then they'll be out of the house for X number of hours per day. But then they're going to come back, and you will be listening to them. And you will be giving counsel to them. You will be imparting wisdom to them and instructing them in so many things about life itself. And here is the father saying to his son, my son, you listen to what your mother has to say. Now, are dads always right? No, they're not. Are moms always right? No, they're not. But God has appointed them, nonetheless, to have a role and a place within the home and in your life to teach the things of God and to bring to bear upon all matters in life the very principles and values that we find there within the scriptures. Forsake not your mother's teaching. Don't despise her. Don't look down upon her. We read also in the book of Proverbs, chapter 30 and verse 17, it says that the eye that mocks a father and scorns to obey a mother. You know, you can speak in a number of different ways. You can speak with your mouth, big mouth, a mouth that utters things that ought not to be said. There's a tone, there's a spirit, there's a sharp edge as you talk back, particularly to your mother. Maybe not to dad at this particular stage in your life, because he's bigger than you. But, you know, it won't be too many years when probably you'll be looking at your dad eye, you know, eye to eye, as it were, and then you'll raise it just a few inches above him, possibly, and you'll be looking down on your dad. No, the glance is important. You speak with your the glance of your eye, the way in which you look. And it can be a cutting look, as it were, a sharp look. It sends a message as to what you think about what your mother may be saying or what she is teaching you. And you don't, in fact, want to listen. The eye that mocks a father and scorns to obey a mother. You to obey your mother. Now, I think mothers have a right to say, listen, when your dad comes home, he's going to be talking to you. And I think that the matter of discipline is the responsibility of a father. And they must take that role seriously. Don't sweep it under the carpet. But they must expect that maybe the mother is going to say when he comes home at the end of the day, you need to talk to Jack. You need to talk to Ruth. This is what has happened through the day. And you say, well, I've had a bad time at the office. Yeah, maybe, but you've got an even worse time right now because you're dealing with members of your family and you're dealing with a son and you're dealing with a daughter. And they have given me a lot of cheek, etc. So dad, he takes off his coat. He may, in fact, choose to have a shower, etc. He might just have a cup of tea. And then he'll call his son or his daughter and say, look, I need to talk to you. What happened? I want to hear your side of the story. Tell me, this is what your mother said. Is that right? Then he's got to take the appropriate steps to deal with his son and his daughter. But it says here, the eye that mocks a father and scorns to obey a mother will be picked out by the ravens of the valley and eaten by the vultures. You see, the birds of the air, somewhat graphically, are going to be eating on your eyeballs if you disobey your mother. It's as bad as that. You're going to have no eyeballs in those sockets of yours unless you listen and listen respectfully and honorably to your mother. So clearly, by these things, a mother is a leader in the household. Now, it's not just simply in the home, but there are different paths of leadership. There are places where we will excel maybe in leadership. Not everyone is gifted and graced alike. So there will be a leadership role in the school. You may be the captain, the prefect, etc. You may be the captain of the sports team that you belong to. Or you may have a role in the workplace. Who knows, maybe in the nation one day. Local government, federal government, who knows. Or maybe even in the church, you will have some particular role and place. So there are various paths of leadership. You may be directed down this path, someone directed down another path. All of this is necessary. What a privilege. I am to prepare for it and to then eventually discover where I am going to fit into the grand scheme of things to fulfill my role as a leader in one area of life or another. Now, you may want to assume a sort of pious attitude to all of this. And when God calls you to the role of a leader, you may end up being like Moses in some respects, and you start protesting. Well, leadership is not for me. And when God called Moses at the age of 80, Moses said, well, look, you know, I've just started to draw the pension right now. It's not for me. And I've got a few aches and pains in my kneecaps right now. I don't think it should be me. And I've got back pain also, etc. You know, 80 years of age, what are you talking about, you know, that I should be a leader? And so you have one excuse after another. And you end up saying, Lord, do not send me, send my brother. Send my sister to do the work. You know, I'll be behind them, a long way behind them. I mean, in prayer, for example. But you just send them. You don't really know what you're doing. Oh, my Lord, please send someone else. That's what Moses said when he was called to the role of leader. What are your excuses? What are your reasons for somehow saying to God, look, it's a nice thought. Thank you very much for the opportunity. But no, I don't think it's me. Could you really think about somebody else? You know, it could be the case of not only Moses who said, I'm not eloquent. I mean, hey, I don't have the words, etc. Or it could be like Jeremiah. And Jeremiah said, well, you know, I'm young. It's not that I'm old like Moses. I'm not 80 years of age. I'm getting on for 30 maybe. But you see, I am only a child. I do not know how to speak, for I am only a youth. And in either of these cases, or more beside, we're saying, you know, Lord, you don't really know what you're doing. Let me give you some of my own advice and counsel as to whom I think would be best. I'm not overlooking qualifications. There are necessary qualifications. We have to look at those things. But here is God calling these men to serve him. But then we put up barriers, and they appear on the surface, you know, to be good. Yeah, I really, in fact, want your work to advance, and I don't think you're choosing the right person if you actually expect me to do this job. Could you not find somebody else, please? Well, now, there happens to be a crisis in leadership. There is a call to leadership, and we need to prayerfully plan and prepare to assume the privileged role of being leaders, and not, as it were, to be negative and start protesting. But at the same time, we recognize that there is a crisis in leadership. With specific reference to the church, two authors write, there is a leadership crisis in the local church. John MacArthur says, a crisis of leadership faces both the world and the church. J. Oswald Sanders comments, real leaders are in short supply. Not just leaders, but real leaders are in short supply. Long ago, the preacher Sangster, I believe it was, lamented the fact that the church is painfully in need of leaders. This dearth of leadership is far from new. Because we read of God looking for leaders, the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people. The Lord has sought a leader after his own heart. The Lord challenges Jeremiah, go up and down the streets of Jerusalem, look around and consider, search through her squares. If you could find one person who deals honestly and seeks truth, and I will forgive the city. In Ezekiel, we again find the Lord looking for a man from among them who would repair the wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land so that I would not destroy it. But I found no one. The crisis of leadership is not something which is unique to the 21st century, whether it be in the state or in the church. And I don't know about you, your thoughts may be different to mine, but I look for leaders in the state. Where are the leaders in the state? They're all very diplomatic. We can say that. They all pat one another on the back, so it appears to be, generally speaking. But where are those strong, stalwart leaders, people of character, that we somehow have to go back over decades, maybe even centuries, to actually feel some kind of oneness with? And what about in the church itself? Where are those strong leaders with fortitude and with determination? Again, it's almost as if we have to sort of go back. There are leaders, thank God for them. They are to be found. They're scattered here and there. They are strong apologists for the faith, and they have that theological acumen so they can lead the body of Christ people in our day and age. But when we come to the local church, when we come to churches in general, where is the leadership? God is looking for men after his own heart. God is looking for men who will fill the gap. God is looking for those who will be intercessors and who will be leaders. There is a crisis in leadership. And this is something that we ourselves ought to be praying about and praying for. That leads me to consider the challenge of leadership. One writer says, leadership has been described as wearing a bullseye on your chest during hunting season. Leading is very likely the most costly thing you will ever do. Leadership is a walk on the wild side. Well, there's a great element of truth in all of that. You're going to be target number one if you assume the role of a leader. It's like walking on the wild side, most definitely. You're going to be singled out. You're not going to be missed. And you're going to encounter tension and resistance and resentment and opposition. And you'll be torn, as it were, in different directions as a leader. There will be this group and that group, and there'll be like a couple of terriers with a bone pulling in different directions. And you're in the midst. You're the meat in the middle of the sandwich, as it were. How are you going to handle with that? How are you going to cope with that? That there is a challenge to leadership, and it involves a cost. It's not how much you're paid. That's not the cost. It is the cost to yourself personally, with regards to who you are, even as a person. Can you continue? There are great numbers. I think in the United States, one of the recent statistics that I came across, with regards to the men leaving the ministry, not every year, but every month in the United States, is 1,500. 1,500 leaving. Why? Well, I mean, sometimes it could be a matter of health. We know that. But very often it's because of the crises within the church, because you're managing people. We're dealing not with four-legged sheep, but two-legged sheep. I don't know. Two-legged sheep seem to have a will of their own. And you're sometimes having to face these particular issues. Sometimes it's the wife. She never really expected that this is what being a pastor's wife would be, or what it would mean to be the wife of a missionary. You know, where he is going, what he's going to be up against. And it becomes somewhat a test time for both of them, both couples. And the husband, of course, needs the support very much of the wife. There is a challenge to leadership. Welcome to leadership. It's a roller coaster of a ride, and the ups and downs will churn the stomach, twist the gut, and make you cry out more than once, "Oh, that I had the wings of a dove, then I would fly away and be at rest. Yes, I would wander far away, and I would lodge in the wilderness." Is that unrealistic? No, it isn't. How many times you may cry out, "Oh, for the wings of a dove, that I might fly away and be at rest." Is it unrealistic that your gut is sort of churned inside out? Definitely not. Out of personal experience, I can know 3 months when my gut was turned and torn backwards and forwards over one particular period in my life. That was one before the others followed it. And there were several others afterwards. And you have to face that with respect to the mental, emotional, social, physical effects that you may encounter as a leader. There is a cost and there is a price to be paid. But think about it now and be willing to pay that price. How many men are leaving the ministry because of so-called burnout? Why? What do you expect when you go into the ministry? What do you expect when you become a leader? You're going to be burnt, but you don't have to be burned out. You're going to be finding stress and encountering difficulties, etc., along the way. But hey, you're going to have to be the captain of the ship. And though there are rough storms ahead of you, you better stick at the helm and ensure that the crew are involved in doing what they need to do in this critical period in their life until you pass through the storm. You need to do that. And how are you going to stand? Do it on your knees. That's where you need to stand, on your knees. J.C. Ryle said, as I've mentioned this before, no gain without pain. And there is no growth without change, no change without loss, and no loss without pain. The bottom line is, If you're not hurting, you're not leading. That's an interesting comment, isn't it? Don't have to agree with the person who said it. It wasn't me, actually, I'm quoting. And the person who said it says this again, let me remind you. If you're not hurting, you're not leading. If you're leading, you're going to hurt somewhere along the line. Difficulties are God's curriculum for those who want to excel. Difficulties are God's curriculum for those who want to excel. The supreme leader of our profession, the Lord Jesus, leads leaders, and he leads them all the way to the cross. If you follow the great leader, the chief apostle of our faith, the Lord Jesus, the pioneer of our faith, if you follow him and would be like him as a leader, then you must be prepared to suffer the cross. What are the chief requirements of leadership? Well, first of all, wisdom. Wisdom. We are told in Proverbs 8 and verse 11, wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things one may desire cannot be compared with her. I want to ask you, dads and moms that are here tonight, is that what you teach your children? In terms of values and priorities, is that what you have been teaching them over the years? There is something more important than wealth, that is material wealth, and that is wisdom. Now, of course, we want our kids maybe to do their best at school. Yeah, fine. Hopefully they'll go to college, maybe go to university. Fine. They're going to establish themselves in their chosen career, and then they're going to earn an income, and they're maybe going to get married, and they're going to have to meet a number of different costs which they've already begun to meet, etc. Yeah, that's fine. And we'll do everything that we can to encourage our children in that direction. But have we instilled within their hearts and made this impression, left it indelibly upon their minds, that there is something far more important than wealth and material gains? Yeah, it's nice to have a nice house. It's nice to drive a nice car. It's nice maybe to pull a boat along with you to go down to the river and to go out into the ocean and do fishing. Sure, that's fine. But is that what it's all about? What does the writer mean? Is he speaking nonsense, or is he speaking something that I need to learn and to be reminded of again and again, that wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things one may desire cannot be compared to wisdom. What do you desire? What do you long for? In chapter 16 and verse 16, how much better to get wisdom than gold? And to get understanding is to be chosen rather than silver. Or going back to chapter 3 and verses 13 and 18, and as far as chapter 3 is concerned, then we certainly commit to memory very often verse 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. Well, we know where that comes from. We might even be able to quote it off by heart. But what about chapter 3, verses 13 onwards? Happy is the man who finds wisdom, and the man who gains understanding, for her proceeds are better than the profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things you may desire cannot compare with her. Length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honor. As godly parents, we should do something that the world is not doing when it raises its own children. Now, you may have neighbors, of course, who are not Christians. They may be of different religions, different faiths, or no faith. But there are some things about them which, hey, you can sort of acknowledge that, you know, they're doing a good job with those kids. They're feeding them well, they're clothing them well, they're sending them to the nicest and the best schools, etc. They're teaching them the importance of courtesies and manners, which seem to be rather rare in these days that we're living in. They're encouraging them to get a good job and a good education first, of course, and then the good job afterwards. So we acknowledge that indeed the non-Christian parent certainly has a direction in life which, yeah, it seems to be very good and plausible. But you see, for the Christian parent, we go beyond that. In fact, it may not always be circumstantially possible to provide for our children those nice clothes and to send them to that private school and so on and so forth. But what you can teach your children is that wisdom which is from above, which is first pure, and then it is peaceable. If we're only interested in our kids somehow getting a decent education, getting a decent job, being able to settle down for the rest of their life and have a nice little house in a nice little suburb and have a nice little brood around us, as it were, if that's all that matters, we have failed absolutely as Christians. However decent, however nice those kids may be within the community. If we have not desired from our hearts that our children be born again, that they be regenerate, that they be the followers of Jesus Christ, and that they will willingly lay down their lives for Jesus Christ, we have failed as parents. As Christian parents, that is. Whatever else we may have given them. And we may have given them the best of this world, but if we have not pointed them to the best in the world to come, then we have failed them, and we should not be very satisfied. If you go back to 1 Kings chapter 3, and this, of course, will be well known to the majority of you who know your Old Testament, and this has to do with Solomon, the son of David. And there in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 5, we read, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask, what shall I give you? And Solomon said, you have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord, my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice, behold, I have done according to your word. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. So walk in my ways, keep my statutes and my commandments, etc. What is it that Solomon the king wanted? Well, he wanted wisdom. And here we have in Proverbs 8 these words, by me, that is by wisdom, kings reign and rulers decree justice. I have a book in my library given by a most dear friend who wrote in it these words. Dear and beloved child of God, may you be granted wisdom to understand things, a teachable heart and all grace necessary for all undergoing changes. May you be granted strength that enable you to persevere. Let Christ in all his greatness be shown through you. May you be granted wisdom. As I reflect on those words that were written in the book that I have, I learned a couple of things. One is wisdom is a gift. It is granted. And so Solomon, Solomon himself, he prayed for this gift. Secondly, wisdom is the ability to be able to understand, to discern. It's the practical application of knowledge. Again, wisdom is planted in the heart of one who is teachable. You need to be teachable. And God plants his wisdom in the heart. And wisdom is that which through grace enables us to face all manner of change that we may encounter in the future. If you look at Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 5 and 7, you learn there that wisdom is a priority. Get wisdom, get understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Verse 7, wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and in all you're getting, get understanding. Young men and women, and all people, do you, even now, and will you, until your dying day, seek wisdom, pursue wisdom, embrace wisdom? And why would you not? Because wisdom personified is none other than the Lord Jesus, who is made unto us wisdom. In him are to be found all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And the pursuit of wisdom will lead you to Christ, because he is that wisdom of God by whom all things were made. Wisdom is a priority. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives and who does so gladly and willingly. Wisdom is not only a priority, wisdom is practical, because it is the skillful application of knowledge. You look at Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 2 following, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. That's why we should seek wisdom. You want to be a leader? You need wisdom. It's the foundation of good leadership. It is a priority, it is very practical, and of course, it has to do with a person. Proverbs 8:22, whatever your thoughts may be on this passage, Jewish commentators and Christian commentators have seen in this passage here a picture of a person. It's wisdom personified. And here is wisdom. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I have been established from everlasting, from the beginning before there was ever an earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth. While as yet he had not made the earth or the fields or the primal dust of the world, when he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters would not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him, and apart from him was nothing made that is made. Then I was beside him as a master craftsman. I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and my delight was with the sons of men. Here's wisdom personified. Isn't it a reference to the Lord Jesus Christ? Well, there are other things that I would like to draw your attention to with respect to wisdom. But again, as with this morning, it may be suitable at this time that I stop at that particular point. Just again to remind you that here is a call to leadership. There is a crisis in leadership today, but we are called nonetheless to take on the responsibility of leadership. There are many challenges that we are going to face. In order that we might assume that role, certain things are needed and required, among which is wisdom. We need wisdom. What we will go on to talk about is the need to listen as leaders. Leaders are not those who simply talk and let no one else do the talking. They are those who have one mouth and two ears. They keep their mouth closed for a large part of the time, and they keep their ears open for most of the time, so that they can listen and become good leaders of those who are talking to them and opening up their heart to them. Pray that God will give us leaders. Pray that we ourselves will strengthen those who are in the role of leadership, whether it is in the home, whether it is in the workplace, whether it is in the church, or whether it is in the state or nation at large. Pray that all who are leaders for Christ will serve Christ and honor him in thought and word and deed for his name's sake. Amen.